This is The Takeaway. I'm Sarah Gonzalez, a host and reporter with NPR's Planet Money podcast, in for Tanzina Vega all week, broadcasting from LA. On Friday, the April jobs report was released, and things aren't looking as rosy as many economists were predicting. With vaccinations increasing and cities and states across the U.S. lifting pandemic-related restrictions, economists expected April to bring a huge hiring surge. But according to the U.S. Labor Department, the unemployment rate actually rose from 6% in March to 6.1% in April. Employers added just 266,000 jobs overall. In March, by the way, more than 700,000 jobs were added. In a speech Friday, President Joe Biden tried not to dwell too much on the negative trends and instead used the jobs report to hit home the necessity of his administration's recent actions on the economy, including his $1.9 trillion pandemic relief package.
Our efforts are starting to work, but the climb is steep and we still have a long way to go.
Although investors are still anticipating job growth in the coming months, the financial toll of the pandemic on low and middle income Americans is still dramatic. Millions of people around the country remain unemployed. And in some ways, such a slow recovery might say less about the pandemic and more about the fundamental nature of the U.S. economy and how it could be changing permanently. So let's talk about it. Heather Long is an economics correspondent for The Washington Post. Heather, always great to have you here.
Hi, Sarah. Good to be back.
Also with us is William Spriggs, professor in the Department of Economics at Howard University and chief economist to the AFL-CIO. William, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you for having me.
William, were you surprised that the unemployment actually went up a little? Were you expecting that?
At some point, I expected the unemployment rate to go up as people returned to the labor market and were beating the jobs that were being created. And that is what happened for African Americans. But I was more surprised of the weakness outside of the rebound we're seeing in the restaurant industry. I just had not been thinking that we would have that much weakness in manufacturing, and especially with the economy expanding, weakness with temporary help.
William, the most optimistic economists have been sort of predicting that the labor market could be back to its pre-pandemic levels by the end of the year. There are still more than 8 million jobs left to recover. Are there more concerns now about whether we'll recover all the remaining jobs?
I hope there will be, because with the large number of long-term unemployed workers, there was no way prior to this report, there was no way I saw we could erase the deficit we have in the labor market by September, when key elements of the reform to the unemployment insurance system will lapse. And now I think more people will start to pay attention to what we are going to have to do in September to extend some provisions of the modernization of the unemployment insurance system, because we're going to still have, obviously, millions of people either long-term unemployed or still having difficulty connecting to the labor market.
Okay. Heather, why do we think we saw fewer jobs added in April than in March? What's the main issue here? Are businesses just still not hiring, or are businesses struggling to find enough workers?
I think there's two good explanations for what happened. One is the Wall Street explanation. You still saw the stock market rallying on Friday. And that is, a lot of investors just shrugged this off. They sort of said this is an anomaly or a blip, and that we are still going to see a pretty strong economy and probably some big months of hiring this summer, later this summer. That's one way to read things. Okay, that maybe there was just some weird seasonal adjustment that the Labor Department did, particularly as Bill Spriggs was explaining, some of those industries like construction. I mean, we all know there's this boom in housing right now. These home prices are through the roof, and yet construction added no jobs, which was kind of a head scratcher.
Wow.
But I think the second explanation, which is probably in my mind the more correct one, is I talk to unemployed workers pretty much every day, and I hear three things over and over again. You know, the first is a lot of people are still a little nervous about going back to work, given that we're still in a pandemic and they haven't gotten their first or second shot yet. You know, they're trying to get vaccinated, but they're not quite fully vaccinated yet. The second one that's overwhelming I hear is childcare concerns. Even though many schools have reopened, a lot of kids are back maybe 2 days a week, 3 days a week in the classroom. It's not full time in many parts of the country yet. And you can see in this report, it was interesting, pretty much all the job gains went to men. We actually saw women's employment fall a tiny bit, and particularly women's labor force participation. That's women employed or even looking for work. That pulled back by about 64,000. So raising that red flag again that things are still not quite right for a lot of moms in this pandemic. And the last thing I hear, and I called this in a piece that ran in the front page of the Washington Post over the weekend, I called it the great reassessment. I hear, you know, this past year has been so psychologically damaging. We've all been through so many horrible experiences. And a lot of workers tell me, I'm not going to go back. I've really rethought my life. I'm rethinking what I want to do with my career. And I've talked to folks, you know, at the high end of the spectrum who are retiring early or retiring from their corporate job to do something they feel was more meaningful. I've also talked to retail workers and restaurant workers who say, I'm not going to rush back to that $11 or $12 hour a job that I felt very dehumanized in and demoralized, where people were yelling at me when I tried to ask them nicely to wear a mask. And they're trying. They are also looking for different careers and looking to shift what they do on a day-to-day basis.
There's been this talking point, mostly from the right, that unemployment benefits are creating a worker shortage. They say unemployment benefits are so good right now, so people don't want to go back to work. Is there any truth to that, Heather?
I think the fairest way to say it, and I'll be interested in what Bill says, but from my perspective, the fairest way to answer this question is, and again, this comes from me talking to unemployed workers pretty much every day. Yes, there are some people who will tell you that they are getting paid more on unemployment than they would if they went back to a job, particularly a job that pays less than $15 an hour, and that is influencing some of their decision. But the overwhelming majority of people I speak to, 9 out of 10, let's say, it's these other three issues that we just talked about. It's health scare still, child care issues still, and then this bigger, deeper question of, do I want to, you know, my whole life changed in the past year. Do I still want to be that same person I was before the pandemic? And it's people, you know, looking to maybe move. I talked to a guy on Friday, you know, used to work for 15 years at a big box retailer. Now he's back in school to be a wind turbine technician. And I just hear more and more stories like that right now.
Well, let's talk a little bit more about safety here, too, because when a job becomes more risky, the way it's supposed to work is the pay goes up. You start paying people more to convince them to take this riskier job. And when people have a safer and, frankly, better deal collecting unemployment, that should also drive up wages. That should make employers go, we need to do something to convince workers to take this job again. This is how it's supposed to work. Is that happening? Are wages in the hospitality industry in particular going up at all, Heather?
So I thought this was another one of the most interesting parts of the April jobs report is we are seeing some evidence of that. So the broad leisure and hospitality category that includes restaurants, basically wages on average are up about a dollar from where they were pre-pandemic. And so that sounds like, okay, they're raising wages a little bit. And you can certainly see these headlines of various restaurants or fast food places offering signing bonuses or other types of perks to lure people back. But at the end of the day, that average wage is still below $18 an hour, somewhere about $17.80. You compare that, what you hear a lot, and you can see it in comments on the Post, Washington Post website on these job stories, people will say, why would I go and take that job when I could have a warehouse job? And warehouse jobs have seen their pay go up by about $1.50. And now the average in that sector is well over $25 an hour. more. So I think another problem, you sort of alluded to it, what you were saying, Sarah, is that so many other fields are paying way, way more than these retail and restaurant jobs. They're still sort of the lowest pay out there. And so it's going to be a struggle for them to lure people back.
William, are there particular sectors of the labor market that are seeing slower job growth than others?
Well, actually, restaurants are doing the best in the last report in terms of adding jobs, which makes this idea that that workers are reticent over the wage issue doesn't make sense. The slowness was in temporary losses in manufacturing, and the perplexing, as Heather pointed out, the perplexing number for construction. Construction, especially residential construction, being among the only industries that has returned to prior February job levels. I think that we in the United States made a mistake by blowing up our labor market. It's a very complex labor market. The restaurant industry in particular relies very heavily on job networks to recruit workers. And it has given them a false sense of what the wage level is. We economists have the hardest time explaining to people why, if you raise the minimum wage, it's not a bad thing. And we use a theory about monopsony, when you're the only buyer, to try and explain to people the conditions under which raising the minimum wage was bad. And people couldn't quite grasp it, because normally you learn about monopsony in the context of, like, I'm the major hotel on an island, and so there's nowhere else to go to get a job. And people would say, but this pizzeria is in the middle of a street. How is it an island? But now when you hear the pizzeria say, I can't find workers in the midst of what we know is very high unemployment rate for restaurant workers, you go, wait, you're acting like you're on an island. And that is how they act, even in a normal economy, because they're only looking at that segment of the labor market that works with their networks. And then, as Heather said, with this long period of workers being separated, they've had to break out of that old network. Many of them did find jobs working in warehousing because that area was expanding. And now essentially those networks aren't there. And the employers, when they go to those networks, aren't getting that many workers anymore.
William, many of the layoffs during the pandemic were supposed to be temporary. Do we know if recent layoffs were of that nature or more permanent?
Well, that was the other disturbing thing in April. There was a spike in layoffs. A large number were people who completed temporary jobs, which pretty much matched the decline in the temporary help agency numbers on the payroll side. And then we saw an equal jump in some people referring to themselves as being on temporary layoff. And again, I think that's one of the things that surprised us, was that we would continue to see numbers losing jobs, offsetting gains. So when you look at the labor flow data, the problem was there was a uptick in people who were employed who transitioned to unemployment compared to the unemployed transitioning to employment. And that gap was narrower. So there was just this general slowdown, in part because of these layoffs and total jobs.
And William, will you remind us, what is the link between the labor market and economic recovery?
The United States does not have a very good matching system. Other nations, employers rely heavily on the public employment service, and they have a higher level of union density. And unions and those employment services tend to do a good job of matching workers. In our system, large segments of workers are hired using networks. These networks are highly segregated, just like our lives are highly segregated. And you can see this particularly in the personal service sector that is the one that blew up. Think about how many times you've been to a restaurant and the workforce seems highly segregated. And you're thinking to yourself, well, if this is a job which in theory many different people could do and within the confines of a city do, why is this establishment look segregated? And that's part of the segregation of our lives and the job networks that the companies rely on to recruit workers. That makes it hard to reconnect people if you have a disruption on the order that we had. In Europe, because they retain workers with their firms, they're not going to have this same issue coming out of this. They're going to have the issue of how many of those firms are going to remain viable once they come out of this. And we will continue to have that difficulty. That's why it's going to be so hard to clear this backlog of unemployed workers. And you're going to continue to hear, I think, especially from restaurants, but other industries that rely heavily on networks, they can't find workers, even though clearly there are millions of unemployed Americans.
Heather, how has government relief from the Biden administration factored into everything that we've been discussing? Have relief checks, for example, allowed for more consumer spending?
We're certainly starting to see a good bit more consumer spending, and we've had over 160 million of those checks or payments, direct deposits in many cases, go out. Obviously, we've seen this also continuation through September of this extra $300 a week for unemployed people. The average unemployment payment is around $300 in normal times. You put another $300 on top of that, many unemployed people are getting around $600 a week and would continue to do that as long as they're still job hunting through the summer. So the relief has made a huge difference. There's no doubt that that's helping to stabilize and improve the economy. This year is expected to be the best year for growth, potentially since the early 1980s. So the outlook is still pretty bright. But the question is, how many workers are going to come back and how quickly? And I think what we normally see in recoveries is growth. The overall economy gets back a lot faster than workers do. We're trying to change that this time around with all of this government support to speed up the rehiring. But obviously, that's why the April jobs report sent off so many alarm bells, because it was so much weaker than expected. I think we really have to watch and see May, June, July. Do we get that burst of hiring that everybody is expecting, or is the economy fundamentally changing? We've certainly seen evidence of a lot more automation and use of robots during this pandemic.
All right. Heather Long is an economics correspondent for The Washington Post, and Williams Briggs is a professor in the Department of Economics at Howard University. Thank you both for joining us.
Thanks, Sarah.
Thank you for having us.
In light of the latest jobs numbers, which were not as good as expected, we wanted to hear from you about what your employment status and personal finances look like as a result of the pandemic. Here's what you told us.
Hi, my name is Jay, and I'm an international student, so I'm not allowed to seek employment outside of campus. My personal finances look dead. Last year I was depleting everything I'd saved to pay for groceries and transportation and some tuition. I barely paid my rent, and the apartment I lived in at the time was not the best with understanding the circumstances. I was very fortunate to move out of there in the middle of last year and find an on-campus job, but I'm still barely there.
My name is Jack from Carrollton, Texas. From the start of the pandemic, I lost half of my income because of my clients would no longer let anyone else in during the pandemic, and they still haven't recovered, mostly daycare centers. And then also, I was working part-time at Panera Bread as a delivery driver, and this past Christmas, they eliminated that position for everybody, and so I've been trying to find a decent paying job, something that pays more than $9 an hour around Dallas-Fort Worth. Just want to find something that's enough money to pay the rent. Thanks. This is Jet in Carrollton, Texas.
I live in a resort area in Colorado, and I work in the financial sector. There are thousands of people who are selling their homes on either coast, and moving here, moving rurally. And interest rates have been so low that people are selling their homes or buying second homes and moving to the country. So that changes the culture of our little town, and the real estate prices have skyrocketed. Financially, this is the best year of my career, but it's also a major cultural shift.
My name is Mark, and I'm from Minneapolis, Minnesota. And I got to tell you, a year ago March, I had COVID early. I was out for a month. I run a handyman service. We fix up houses and repair things. Once I was out of bed, work started flowing in like crazy. Like, the phone's ringing all the time, projects all the time, everywhere. Everyone is tired of sitting in their home and looking at their broken stuff or their stuff that needs to be painted or remodeled or whatever. Secondly, I didn't go out for a year. I have saved literally tens of thousands of dollars by not going out to eat or drink or party or travel. I just stayed home and stayed in my bubble.
I saw my employment go away. I saw myself just jump into entrepreneurship. And to think about really what I want in life and what I want to accomplish before I leave this earth, because who knows, it could be another virus that takes me out. So my finances got shook up, yet got stronger. Watching my credit improve, my FICO score get better, life get better. And as we come out of this pandemic, by the time we're done, I expect to be totally on my feet, strengthened for the future.
As always, we want to hear from you. Give us a call at 877-869-8253 and tell us how the pandemic has changed your personal finances and employment prospects. Or record a voice memo on your phone and email it to us at takeawaycallers@gmail.com. This is The Takeaway.
There are four questions Jews ask to mark Passover every year. This Passover is leading many of us to ask more questions, once tied to our identity as Jewish Americans. I'm Matt Katz, and on the next Notes from America, we'll talk about hard conversations happening in Jewish communities right now, how we can heal our divisions, and why this Passover feels different. Available wherever you get podcasts.
You're listening to The Takeaway. I'm Sarah Gonzalez, in for Tanzina Vega. On Friday, director Barry Jenkins' mini-series adaptation of the Colson Whitehead novel, The Underground Railroad, premieres on Amazon Prime. Both the book and the series center around Cora, an enslaved woman who escapes from a plantation in Georgia and travels through a literal underground train system in search of freedom. And while the series does depict the traumatic reality of slavery, early reviews have lauded it for not sensationalizing the violence shown on screen, as well as for emphasizing the humanity of the enslaved characters. Much of the project's success can be credited to Barry Jenkins, the Oscar-winning filmmaker behind Moonlight and If Beale Street Could Talk. Here he is on The Takeaway back in 2018 talking about his plans for the Underground Railroad.
The most clear thing I can say about it is, you know, it's a hero's journey. And I remember as a kid, you know, hearing about the Underground Railroad for the first time and really, literally imagining choo-choo trains running underground. And so I think that reading Colson's book kind of reactivated that childhood kind of awe, you know, around just like the power, the ingenuity, you know, of Black folks to create this path to freedom. And I thought the best way to tell that was to go on the full hero's journey. And so I was really happy to partner with Amazon and find a place where we could tell the story over the course of 8, 9, 10 hours.
For more on the miniseries, I am joined now by Robert Daniels, contributing film critic to Polygon, The New York Times, and The Los Angeles Times. Robert, thanks for being here.
Hi, Sarah. Thanks for having me on.
So for people who are less familiar with The Underground Railroad, the book and the miniseries, will you just quickly summarize the story for us?
Yeah. So The Underground Railroad is basically an alt history that's set during antebellum South in Georgia. And it follows Cora, who's played by Thuso Mbedu. And she's a slave who was abandoned by her mom, who apparently has run off the plantation over a decade ago. No one knows where she went, not even Cora. And Cora feels like an outcast even on the plantation. Well, at some point, Cora meets a southern slave named Caesar, who's played by Aaron Pierre. And Caesar tells her of an underground railroad, a physical railroad, not just a practical railroad, but a physical railroad that's underground with trains and station houses and station masters. And he says he knows where there's a station house, and if she wants to, she can run with him. And he wants her because she's good luck, because her mom got away. They go and journey through the away from the plantation. And that journey toward freedom is the literal backbone of the Underground Railroad.
You wrote in your review that the first episode of the series was the hardest for you to stomach. Why was that?
Yeah, so the premiere entitled Georgia definitely left me wary. It's gorgeously shot in near celestial lighting. The score is wonderfully calibrated. And yet lots of the violence feels so surreal. Without spoiling the episode, the brutality kind of goes beyond the gruesome practice of lynching. It's surreal to a point. It's spectacle to a point, too. It's as though Jenkins, from the very beginning, throws us into the deep end so that we might swim to a later calm. And while the calm does come, especially in the later scenes, like what I like to call Cora's flight to freedom, I would be lying if I didn't say that the first 30 minutes of the premiere didn't give me pause for how violent it was.
And did it change after the first episode?
Yes, the series definitely becomes calmer. We get into Cora's journey toward freedom. And really, it turns into, one, a love story between her and Caesar. And then later, there's another love story that develops between her and Royal, who's an officer in the Underground Railroad, played by William Jackson Harper. And then it also goes into Cora's relationship to her mother. We never really see her mother except in flashbacks, but her presence is always there. And so it really becomes a discussion of a mother-daughter relationship that's been frayed because Cora doesn't know how to fix it, but she wants to fix it.
And the thing that's really different about this story is there's a literal Underground Railroad, which I think is what children especially think of when they first learn about the Underground Railroad. How does the series visually depict this railway system that Cora travels on? What was it like watching it?
It really was, as Barry Jake has described, like I grew up with also the thought of a literal Underground Railroad.
Yeah.
Like there's this place where people go to, it's like the CTA here in Chicago, and like they get on the train and it takes them to freedom, and that's just how it works. And that's almost how Barry Jenkins visualizes it. It's so fantastical and so magical. The train is depicted as almost alive, right? It's like this kind of energy that's driving it toward the people who most need it. There's not really a timetable or a schedule. No one knows when these trains are going to arrive, when they're departing, but each station has a station master, and they have a book where you have to tell your story in order to get onto the train. And so the train is almost carrying the message or the history of Black people from station to station. And the physical train itself, which is I believe Jenkins said that they actually found a private railway system and literally physically built the cave walls around it, is tactile. It's real. Some of the station houses are just in caves. Some of them look like New York City subway stations and with tiled yeah. mosaics and stuff like that. So the production design of this is so fantastic and feels so lived in.
Nice. You wrote in your review that in movies and television shows about slavery, there's usually a lot of pain and suffering and violence depicted, sensational violence. And there are things this series accomplishes that you hadn't really seen before in a movie or show about slavery. What were they?
I think what I had seen accomplished was that Barry Jenkins found a humanistic lens to look through rather than so much, I don't want to be vapid and call it a white lens or say that he avoids a white lens or that he tries to find a Black tenor to speak through, but I think he finds a very human tenor to speak through. Britt Bennett, who's the author of The Vanishing Half, said a few months ago on Twitter that a lot of the Jordan Peele knockoffs are so bad because they're made by people who thought the horror of Get Out was the Armitages, when in fact it was the sunken place. And I think that's a wonderful approximation for why these works tend to fail. They pose the slave master and the horrendous actions as kind of an object of interest. And because they do that, we only see it through that lens. And so we can only see Black people as less than human, whereby the sum total of the existence amounts to the pain they must endure to find freedom. But I think if you think about it through the horror being the sunken place, like in Get Out, the sunken place is really about Chris's regret over the loss of his mother. And it's a very tangible emotion. And I think Jenkins accomplishes the same in the Underground Railroad by crafting this love story for Cora and Caesar. And how often really do we see love stories in slave narratives? And by exploring the anger and sense of abandonment Cora feels toward her mother. So while the specter of Ridgway, who's played by Joel Edgerton, who's a slave catcher who's hunting Cora, is there, we never really depart from the very humanist image of Cora as a living, breathing entity first.
Robert Daniels is a contributing film critic to Polygon, the New York Times, and the Los Angeles Times. Robert, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Last month, President Biden announced he wanted to boost funding for research on cancer and other diseases.
So many of us have deceased sons, daughters, and relatives who died of cancer. I can think of no more worthy investment. I know of nothing that is more bipartisan. So let's end cancer as we know it. It's within our power. It's within our power to do it.
But experts say the fight against cancer is unwinnable if there isn't also a focus on preventing the disease by regulating carcinogens. The Environmental Protection Agency has historically been slow to act on known carcinogens, and much more research is needed to find out exactly which toxins are making us sick. So what would it actually take to win the war on cancer? Here to explain is Diana Zuckerman, president of the National Center of Health Research. Diana, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks so much for having me.
Okay, first, what kinds of carcinogens are we talking about here? Carcinogens in products sold in stores and in food? Are we talking about environmental exposures?
Well, unfortunately, it's all of the above. There are so many chemicals and other substances that we know can cause cancer, or know that it does cause cancer. And some of them are in our environment, and some of them are in our home environment. Some of them are in our backyards, so that we really need to have that comprehensive view of what is causing cancers and doing something about it.
And what do you make of President Biden's plan? He said he wants to eradicate cancer. What does that realistically look like?
Clearly, he's very heartfelt on this issue, but his focus has really been on treatments. And that's why he wants to do a new agency within the National Institutes of Health that would focus on cancer, but focus on it as a treatment. That's what NIH does. I mean, they do look at causes, but they're not looking so much at prevention. And that's what's been missing always. And that's rather typical of political leaders.
Okay, so there's more of a focus on treating cancer versus preventing cancer. Can you tell us what has the so-called war on cancer looked like in the past?
So far, the war on cancer has looked at what is called prevention, but is actually early diagnosis. So you hear a lot about screening. There's a lot of interest in screening for all kinds of cancers where that's possible. And that is effective at diagnosing early, but it isn't really prevention usually. But most kinds of screening, whether it's mammograms or other kinds of screening that people are most knowledgeable about, really is about finding an early cancer, but the cancer is already there. And so that's why the war on cancer has always been very limited, because it's focused on the cancer once it's started, rather than looking at how can we prevent it to begin with.
Biden did mention prevention in his speech. He talked, I think, more specifically about screening for cancer. What are your thoughts on that approach?
it's a good approach as far as it goes, but it is not the way to really end cancer. If we want to end cancer, we've got thousands and thousands of chemicals that we're being exposed to, many of us, every day. These chemicals are in our bodies. The various federal agencies have studied them, and they know that we have them in our bodies. And what we don't know usually is how high those levels have to be to cause cancer, and that's always going to be different for different people. So if you want to end cancer as we know it, you would want to have much more information about what are these levels, which are the chemicals, what are the combination of chemicals, and who are the people who are most vulnerable, most likely to develop cancer if they are exposed to particular chemicals and other substances.
Deanna, public health experts who have spent their careers examining environmental causes of cancer say it may not be possible to truly stop cancer without the EPA stepping in. What is President Biden's strategy?
We haven't heard about a strategy pertaining to EPA, although his administration has already started to make some corrections of where EPA has been going in the last couple of years. I should just say that at the end of the Obama administration, an amendment to what's called the Toxic Substances Control Act, or TSCA, an amendment was made that was a bipartisan effort. It was a very big deal at the time of a compromise between what new chemicals and what old chemicals would finally be studied and perhaps in some cases taken off the market in exchange for giving states less control over what they did. So, for example, states like California tended to have much higher standards than other states. So the purpose of this compromise legislation was to put everybody on a more similar level playing field. But what happened in the last 4 years was that these new regulations that were supposed to take place, these new reviews and these new efforts to get carcinogenic chemicals off the market just stopped. And they stopped because they stopped doing the right kind of research. They stopped looking at the right kind of research. And so hundreds of new chemicals went on the market that were potentially dangerous but weren't being studied. So the Biden administration has started reversing that, and that's great, but there are thousands of chemicals out there that we still know very little about, but we do know they have the, in many cases, they have the possibility of causing cancer.
And what is the role of regulation here? How is the EPA falling short in terms of the regulation of carcinogens?
EPA is supposed to look at the new chemicals as they are ready to go on the market and not allow them on the market if they show signs of being carcinogenic, and instead requiring that they be studied. But there's still thousands of old chemicals that have already been on the market. And so there's this huge backlog, and EPA needs to look at those as well. So EPA was supposed to find the chemicals that were most likely to cause cancer. And by that, I mean ones that probably we already know cause cancer, but we just don't know under what conditions they cause cancer. So that was what the EPA was supposed to be doing the last few years and stopped doing. And under the Biden administration, some of these policies have been reversed back to what the law is supposed to require, which is reviewing and then taking action.
So they just stopped reviewing whether certain products sold in stores are carcinogenic or potentially carcinogenic. It's interesting. Every time I see a warning on a product that says, you know, this is potentially carcinogenic, I'm like, why do we even allow this to be sold in stores then if it's possibly carcinogenic?
That's such a good question. And by the way, just in the last couple of days, there have been new reports about new evidence. And I'll just very briefly mention what they are. The Inspector General of EPA came out saying that EPA need to do a better job. So that's a good step in the right direction, where they're saying, oops, you know, there are certain chemicals that we should be looking at more carefully that we haven't looked at yet. And in addition to that, a new study came out showing that PFAS, which are these chemicals known as forever chemicals, they've been in the news a lot lately, do cause kidney cancer. And that was in a journal called the Journal of National Cancer Institute. It was already assumed or thought that PFAS could cause kidney cancer or testicular cancer, but now we have a new study showing that people who have more PFAS in their bodies, in their blood, are much more likely to be diagnosed with kidney cancer.
And where do we find this chemical PFAS?
Well, unfortunately, it's everywhere. I mean, it's in our homes, definitely. It's in stain-proof carpeting. It can be in our nonstick cookware, and it's also, you know, outside as well. So this is is something that has been in the news a bit lately, but I think a lot of people are still not aware of. You know, you have all of these different chemical abbreviations, the PFAS, the PFOA. You know, people do get confused, but and for good reason. But we're now finding very clear evidence that these chemicals not only cause cancer, but they accumulate and they don't go away. And that's why they're called forever chemicals, because they last for many, many years.
Okay. And how much is the White House focusing on environmental causes of cancer?
It seems not much. Another new study that came out about air pollution found that, not surprisingly, that, you know, air pollution can cause lung cancer, breast cancer, liver cancer, and pancreatic cancer. So there, you know, we really need at least a two-pronged approach if we want to end cancer. And treatment is very important. Screening is very important. But we need to look inside our homes, as well as air pollution and other emissions outside our homes.
The timing of this announcement is interesting. It seems like the scramble to research and treat COVID-19 moved some of our attention and funding away from cancer research. But it also seems like the success of the COVID vaccines have also shown us what can happen when we put a bunch of resources into trying to solve a big health problem.
That's absolutely true. We've certainly realized that if you throw a lot of money at a problem under certain circumstances with a lot of motivation, you can achieve what seemed absolutely impossible. But it is true that it's been hard for, to get attention to cancer issues when COVID has really taken over not just our lives, but our news cycles.
Diana Zuckerman is the president of the National Center for Health Research. Diana, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay, everyone, that's your Monday takeaway. Appreciate you being along for the ride on my first day back filling in. We're going to be talking a lot this week, so make sure you are part of the show. Call us at 877-869-8253. That's 877-8-MY-TAKE. Or click on Contact Us on thetakeaway.org and record a message there. If you want to follow me and my work on Planet Money, you can follow me on Twitter at GonzalezSarahA. Thanks so much for spending part of your day with us. I'm Sarah Gonzalez, broadcasting from Los Angeles all week. I'm sitting in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. See you tomorrow.